The world is like a ride at an amusement park. And when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud. And it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real or is this a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride.
He was the type of guy that you'd watch him as a comedian and you'd kind of feel bad. You'd kind of go, you know, I should be doing more of this kind of thing. I really should be telling the truth more often.
Because I greased my hair and I'm a little fucking poet tonight, all right? I'm the little dark poet. That's who I am.
Bill had a lack of concern. He wasn't concerned with what the audience thought, who would boo him. He wasn't concerned with how it would affect his business. He just said what he wanted to say.
I said to Bill, you know, you're just that far from being a preacher. And he said, I am a preacher.
My voice was not heard. The questions were not asked that I wanted to see asked.
He's really an ass-kicking comedian, you know, the best kind, the only kind that matters. When jokes mean, the jokes are meant to kill.
How many, quickly, how many non-smokers are here tonight? Non-smokers. By round of applause, let's hear non-smokers. Good.
I love being in New York. I love running the bum gauntlet down every street. God, I hate those guys, man. Very idea they want me to just give them the hard-earned money my folks send to me every week. Leech. Get a job. My dad works 8 hours a day for this quarter. I mean, the nerve.
Many good artists have an inner voice, and for whatever reason, some people can hear their inner voice and others can't. And I think his was questioning what was going on around him, from religion to politics to sexuality, drug use, evolution. He was just a very engaged person who felt compelled to make comedic chestnuts out of all these complex issues, and he was clearly gifted at it and challenged not only his audiences, but I think other comedians.
It's time that we as God's people took a stand and said to our kids, no, no!
A lot of Christians wear crosses around their necks. Do you think when Jesus comes back, he ever wants to see a fucking cross? It's kind of like going up to Jackie Onassis with a little sniper rifle pendant, you know? Hey, Jackie, just thinking of John.
The first time we heard about Bill performing on stage was at our church camp when he was 13 years old. And I heard about it from some of the ladies in my Sunday school class who asked me if Bill had gone to church camp, which he had. And then one of the ladies told me that her son said that he was the funniest thing he had ever heard. So after Sunday school, I went to our assistant pastor who had been the camp pastor and asked him what Bill did. And he said, well, Mary, he is very funny, but you may look at how you raised him.
The Prince of Peace is back, but he's pissed off. Fuck you, puppet.
I couldn't understand why Bill used the F word so much. And I think I said, well, Bill, I don't hear Bob Hope using it or any other well-known comedian. And, of course, he didn't like that, and he didn't like Bob Hope too much, or anybody that I would mention. So, he took issue with that statement.
I did that joke in Alabama. These three rednecks met me after the show. Hey, buddy, come here. Hey, Mr. Comedian, come here. Yeah, I love that move. Come here. Not a physics major. That's a safe bet. Mr. Funny Man, come here. Hey, buddy, we're Christians. We don't like what you said. I said, then forgive me.
He was that odd sort of person that could sort of hate where he came from, but love it too. I mean, some of his most savage attacks would be on religious or things in the South, yet that's where he came from. I mean, so he could go home. He could ultimately love it and hate it at the same time.
I was in Nashville, Tennessee last year. After the show, I went to a Waffle House. I'm not proud of it. I was hungry. And I'm alone. I'm eating and I'm reading a book, right? Waitress walks over to me. Hey, what you reading for? Sound like the weirdest fucking question you've ever heard. Not what am I reading, but what am I reading for? Well, goddamn it, you stumped me. Why do I read? I guess I read for a lot of reasons, and the main one is so I don't end up being a fucking waffle waitress.
Bill and I both shared the love of the South and its sweetness and just really originality. It's like a very, one of the few really still original places, I think, in America. And Bill knew that. But anytime you love something that much, you see all of its flaws tenfold.
But then this trucker in the next booth gets up, stands over me and goes, well, looks like we got ourselves a reader. What the fuck's going on here? It's not like I walked into a Klan rally in a Boy George outfit. God damn it, it's a book.
Please put it together. Give a warm Austin welcome for Dwight Zink. Thank you. Thank you very much. Keep a nice applause going for Louie, ladies and gentlemen. Fresh out of rehab.
Well, 1978, the Comedy Workshop opened up in Houston, Texas, and it was very exciting for us because we were 15 years old, and this was what we were waiting for. But the support for our parents to leave our homes on a school night and go to a nightclub was unrelentless. We couldn't do it. We were grounded basically for the rest of our adolescence. And the only way to do it was to sneak out. So Kevin Booth would drive up. Bill would sneak out of his window. And drive over to my house. I would sneak out of my house. We would get in the car, go down to the workshop and do our sets under the pretenses that we were at the library. It was very strange. I mean, we were all underage. In fact, I think Bill and Dwight had to have some kind of a special permit to be allowed to perform. So it was very weird going from our high school keg parties and everything to this adult world. And then is what really made it weird was when Bill kind of started to rule this adult world, and he wasn't even old enough to be drinking alcohol yet, and all of a sudden he was, you know, he was blowing the other older comedians off the stage.
I knew he was writing these jokes, but I did not know what that meant. And one time I was home from college, I guess, and he said, come down to the Comedy Workshop, which was a place in Houston. And I said, well, why? I'd never been to a comedy club. It just wasn't a big thing. And he said, well, just come down there tonight. So I went down that night, and I couldn't believe it. He was a superstar already. He was like 15 years old, maybe 14 years old. And there was a sold-out show, lines waiting to get in. And that was my brother. I couldn't believe it.
Night time! Quit smoking, kids. But I fucking did it. And yes, I miss them. It is hard to quit smoking. Every one of them looks real good to me right now. Every cigarette looks like it was made by God, rolled by Jesus, and moistened shut with Claudia.
folks are proud of me. Bill, honey, you still doing that suck your own cock, Bill? Yeah, Mom. Good, baby. That's such a crowd pleaser. How clever of you to come up with a suck your own cock bit, honey. You're so clever it makes your mama's bosom swell with pride. Knowing her son is traveling the world using his given surname, going up in front of rooms of total strangers, and doing the suck your own cock piece. Thanks, Mom. No biggie.
When he was up in high school, they used to give him 5 minutes before class to get all that out of his system so they could proceed with the class, and we heard that. So.
Well, one of the teachers called me and asked me if I could help her get her class back from Bill. She said I told him he could have 5 minutes while I was checking the roll, and she said, I can't get it back. I said, that's your problem. You shouldn't have let him get up there.
Honey, I want your boy to come play at our house.
He was taking fully the role of the kind of the witch doctor in front of the audience. I mean, really, you got a performance going on here, and it's like a big, giant exorcism of all the evil shit that's inside of us that poisons us day to day to day. It just adds up, gets locked into our brains. We can't get it out. We don't know what to do with it. TV talk shows aren't going to help it. The news isn't. Nothing's going to help it. You just need a guy to get up there and just take you by the lapels and shake the shit out of you.
I am Goat Boy.
What do you want, Goat Boy?
Big old smelly, shaggy thing.
He was dark, and he had some very dark images that he wanted to explain to people in graphic detail. Yeah, so he would shock people, and it would shock people into paying attention or just being surprised that he would say things like that.
Goat Boy is here to please you. Tie me to your headboard. Throw your legs over my shoulders and let me wear you like a feed bag.
Relationship was based around, like, you know, writing wacky songs and taking these photographs of ourselves, like trying to make ourselves look like rock stars. I really thought Bill and I were going to go on to be in a band together forever, and then he decided to be a stand-up comic, and so he was kind of split on that thing. But
he always wanted to be a musician. I mean, rock star, yeah. I think was the number one thing.
He was fascinated with, you know, Alice Cooper and rock music and you know, the Jimi Hendrix story, and he was a Kiss. He was fascinated by those theatrics and that power.
I've hesitated to call Bill Hicks a rock and roll comedian, but what I would say about him is that he has managed very successfully to take the things that appeal to teenage and 20-something audiences in pop music out of the records and put them into a live comedy routine. The reason a lot of young, middle-class people didn't used to be interested in comedy at all was because that the comedians weren't talking about anything that they were interested in. And the reason they were into music instead was because the musicians were. Bill Hicks has taken a lot of those concerns and he's put them into humorous situations. And that's why he has a rock and roll appeal.
It's great to be here. Hi, thank you. I've been on the road doing comedy for 10 years now, so bear with me while I plaster on a fake smile and plow through this shit one more time.
Most comedians perform in front of television audiences and don't have a life in front of an audience, a real long life in front of the public. But he was performing like, you know, 250, 280 days a year, he told me. And therefore, he really is good, masterful with an audience, easy, at ease with an audience. He could think on his feet.
By the way, if anyone here is in advertising or marketing, kill yourself. Thank you. Just a little thought. I'm just trying to plant seeds.
Maybe. Maybe one day they'll take root. I don't know. You try. You do what you can. Kill yourselves. Seriously, though, if you are, do. Not really. There's no rationalization for what you do, and you are Satan's little helpers. Okay? Kill yourself. Seriously. You're the ruiner of all things good. Seriously. No, this is not a joke. He's going to be a joke coming. There's no fucking joke coming. You are Satan's spawn, filling the world with bile and garbage. You are fucked, and you are fucking us. Kill yourself. It's the only way to save your fucking soul. Kill yourself.
Wasn't like a guy who just comes up and stands at a mic and lays out one-liners, but rather that there's this sort of tornado moving around the stage and cycling around and throwing all this energy out at you.
And it was just his bravery, you know, where he was able to go on stage. And because you look at him as well, like he played the Dominion, and for any comedian over here to play the Dominion, they'd be kind of going, no pause, and just quickly get the material out, like, you know. And you can see Bill on stage just reflecting. And, like, you know, thinking, what am I going to think about next?
I know what all the marketing people are thinking right now, too. Mm. Oh, you know what Bill's doing? He's going for that anti-marketing dollar. That's a good market. He's very smart. Oh, man, I am not doing that. You fucking evil scumbags.
For all the talk about Bill being like Hendrix or Dylan or Jim Morrison or Lenny Bruce, it was Jesus Bill wanted to be. He wanted to save us all. But Bill got freeze-framed in the scene where Jesus went through the temple and said, this is my Father's house and you've turned it into a den of thieves. Because that's what Bill always wanted to do. He wanted to be Christ at his angriest.
You know what Bill's doing now? He's going for the righteous indignation dollar. That's a big dollar. A lot of people are feeling that indignation. We've done research. Huge market. He's doing a good thing. God damn it, I'm not doing that, you scumbags. Quit putting a goddamn dollar sign on every fucking thing on this planet.
I personally do not believe in burning the flag. It's a personal belief, but I'll tell you something. I think people are overreacting. Oh, just a little bit. Hey, buddy, my daddy died for that flag. Well, I bought mine. Sorry. You know, they sell them at Kmart for $3. You're in, you're out, brand new flag. No violence was necessary. Hey, buddy, my daddy died in the Korean War for that flag. What a coincidence. My flag was made in Korea.
America is a place that you love and you hate at the same time because everything is here, everything possible, every possible evil and every possible good. And it's very frustrating for somebody like Bill, whose antennas are always open and he's lays himself open, his heart and his mind, to see all the hypocrisy and contradictions of what we could really be and what we are.
Comedians are one of the few people around who really have license to tell the truth, you know? Movies don't really have it, and certainly television personalities don't really have it. Comedians do, because ultimately they're only responsible to themselves. They're not responsible to a studio or a network or a corporate entity, you know? And for that reason, they have probably more license to tell the truth than anybody, and most of them don't take it. Bill took it, and you have to admire that about him.
First of all, this needs to be said. There never was a war.
How can you say that, Bill?
Well, a war is when two armies are fighting. So you see, right there, I think we can all agree what exactly a war.
I had a very, very big, one of the top comedians in this country tell me during the Iraq War that they couldn't do it. They said they wouldn't put their neck on the line. They were against the war and they wouldn't say anything because they basically felt that you watch those little bags of money just fly away. It's like, kiss your career goodbye.
He had absolutely phenomenal stuff about the Gulf War, and it was because you get the English comics coming out and going, hey, the Gulf War, and doing some really dodgy, you know, crap stuff about it, and Bill just went out and went, look, this is what's happening, and like
I have to go find it now then.
No, not now. You gotta go to number four. Go to number four.
You actually thought for a moment, here's a comedian who actually knows more than me about a subject. And besides knowing more about a subject, he's been very funny about it.
Those guys were in hog heaven out there. You understand, man? They had a big weapons catalog opened up. What's G12 do, Tommy? Well, it says here it destroys everything but the fillings in their teeth. Helps us pay for the war effort. Well, shit, pull that one up. Pull up G12, please. Cool. What's G13 mean?
See, I think Bill said a lot of things that were so true that, you know, they just couldn't deal with it. I mean, you can't, certain people can't take but so much truth. And he would never, he, with me, I would tell you truth, but then I'd let you off and I'd tell you something real, real funny and make you laugh. But I'd make you think again and make you laugh. See, you know, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. But wasn't no spoonful of sugars with Bill.
No.
I love talking about the Warren Commission. I love talking about the Kennedy assassination as well. And the reason I do is because I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated that our government could lie to us so blatantly, so obviously, for so long, and we do absolutely nothing about it. I think that's interesting in what is ostensibly a democracy. Sarcasm. Come on in. People say, Bill, quit talking about Kennedy, man. It was a long time ago. Just let it go. All right? It's a long time ago. Just forget it. I'm like, all right, then don't bring up Jesus to me. As long as we're talking shelf life here, you know.
I brought him to the attention of the Letterman show back in the mid-80s, I suppose. He was still too far off the wall for the Tonight Show, which was the more mainstream show. And the late night with David Letterman was sort of the crazy take-a-chance program. And he was well-suited to that. I remember bringing him down and Morty, the producers, and they would hear him and go, Bill, this is good, but can you change this? He'd go in these fits of rage. No, I can't. It's the essence of the bit. You know, we'd have these. I said, look, just get on TV. We just do it. And we go back and forth, back and forth. And then he went on to do, I guess, 11 or 12 Letterman appearances and was pretty, very successful.
Our next guest is a very intense and very funny young man who has been on this program a number of times, and he's back again tonight. He has his own HBO One Night Stand program, which premieres this Saturday. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bill Hicks. Bill!
We had heard of him, and he came on the show, and it did very well, as I recall his first time. And that was great for us because we're always looking for somebody to come on and just blow the roof off the place. And so we thought, this is great. We have a new guy here who has been very effective. And then, of course, you worry, well, can he do it again? You know, will the subsequent shot hold up? And over the years, and I don't know how long he was with us on the old show, but he never disappointed.
I learned a lot about women. I think I learned exactly how the fall of man occurred in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, and Adam said one day, wow, Eve, here we are, at one with nature, at one with God, we'll never age, we'll never die, and all our dreams come true the instant that we have them. And Eve said, yeah, it's just not enough, is it?
We always push the envelope by seeing, okay, just how much of a fuck you attitude can you have without going over the line on network television? And that was always the thrill of presenting him.
I can't quote you club owners or television executives by name, but I know that the nature of what Bill did was not universally applauded and accepted because it did challenge the status quo and might upset certain political sensibilities in the audience and in the corporate structures.
When his stuff was taken off the air for Letterman, he wrote me a 32-page letter. Handwritten, a sort of a creed occur. He couldn't understand the situation just because, you know, he was a free spirit. He was, the whole point of it was a joke. These jokes had import. But it was the prescribing of his freedom which so offended him.
Well, our relationship with Bill Hicks came to kind of a peculiar ending, made all the more peculiar by the man's death. And I have personal regrets about how our relationship developed prior to his death. So it makes me doubly sad that he's now not around so that we can, I think, correct mistakes that were made on his behalf. So I feel a personal sense of regret regarding that.
And what it did also do was give him a more material for his belief, correct in my view, that it was that television worked to control the society, to keep the culture credulous, to keep it from thinking, to enchant it, literally, to spellbind it. And his job, as he saw it, was to break the spell.
Go back to bed, America. Your government has figured out how it all transpired. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here's American Gladiators. Watch this. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Here is American Gladiators. Here is 56 channels of it. Watch these pituary retards bang their fucking skulls together and congratulate you on living in the land of freedom. Here you go, America. You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
With Bill, you always got the impression that stand-up was an end in itself. You know, to many people in the stand-up business, it's just a stepping stone. You know, it's, hey, I'll get a sitcom, I'll have a wacky neighbor, and the next thing I know, I'll be chatting with Regis, you know. And it shows. Bill Hicks wasn't out there just to get some laughs and collect a check.
I'm so sick of arming the world and then sending troops over to destroy the fucking arms. You know what I mean? We keep arming these little countries, then we go and blow the shit out of them. We're like the bullies of the world, you know? We're like Jack Palance in the movie Shane, throwing the pistol at the sheepherder's feet. Pick it up.
I don't want to pick it up, mister. You'll shoot me.
Pick up the gun.
Mister, I don't want no trouble, huh? I just came downtown here to get some Hard Rock candy for my kids, some gingham for my wife. I don't even know what gingham is, but she goes through about 10 rolls a week of that stuff. I ain't looking for no trouble, mister.
You all saw him. He had a gun.
I think his message came from his feelings and his observations of what was happening in this country, and I think he was determined and passionately determined to try to make some changes through this medium.
He was on a mission. He was on a journey, and the point was that he did make that journey exciting for anybody who managed to meet him on it.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one.
I'm going to share with you a vision that I had because I love you and you feel it. You know all that money we spend on nuclear weapons and defense every year, trillions of dollars, correct? Instead, just play with this. If we spent that money feeding and clothing the poor of the world, and it would pay for it many times over, not one human being excluded.
Not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever. In peace. Thank you very much. You've been great. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you very much. You're great.
You guys are great. Thank you very much. Good night.
Okay, everybody. That was Bill Hicks, and he was murdered by the government. And it was February 26th, 1994, when they did that. They gave him a heart attack, just like they did Hugo Chavez, because he just spoke a little bit too much truth for them to listen to. Have you ever heard that statement before in this world? I just thought we would play that because Amy Goodman brought it up here on the 26th. And so there you go. We got to hear that. Soul, speak his truth to power. Okay, I got this song here that. Okay. Yeah, I got this song here because you got to take this machine over there. Okay, now let's listen to this song just for a second here. Then we'll do, Mr. Tabor after this.
Yes.
Okay.
These are things that we need to celebrate. You know, recovery is something that we need to celebrate. Art and people's stories and helping others is something we need to celebrate. And that's what Peace Love strives to do.
You know, violence affects everybody. And recently, a dear friend of mine, returning from a fundraising event, was brutally assaulted on the way to her car. She was beaten so badly and left by the assailant to just die. She managed to pick herself up, get in her car, and drive with her eyes shut to the nearest hospital. Our friend Stuart Hoffman has dedicated this song, You Get More Beautiful, to help in her recovery effort. Now from the album Dance of the Dance, You Get More Beautiful.
Thank you.
Everybody, you do get more beautiful every single day. Now we're going to settle down. I'll just read the last sentence in that article that we were reading on the conference line just to finish it up on the I Ching. And it says, the outcome of this process, I'll read the second last paragraph too. You will not gain the trust of others until you trust yourself. This hexagram gives a teaching on how to gain the kindness of trust that comes from knowing your inner truth. Consciously look at your highest good. To be loved, you must love yourself. To be heard, you must hear yourself. To correct a situation, you must correct yourself and your inner thoughts. Open your heart and let yourself be loved. The outcome of this process is rich, yet the process itself is even richer. At this time, this process is not about choice. It is about necessity. Love, divine compassion, and knowing your inner truth are necessary to bring about this grand success that awaits all of us. This week, be the gentle wind and feel the strength of Mother Gaia. The earth, as she beckons you home, do not talk of love. Be love. Do less. Be more. Many blessings. Bobby K. Bobby Klein. Awesome, 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 everybody. And you can find this I Ching. It comes out every Sunday. So that's why we don't get to read it from after the fact, but you can look it up ahead of time. It's www.theichingweekly.com. And I Ching is spelled I-C-H-I-N-G, weekly.com. Okay, now our sister Karen, who is now in our neck of the woods, she wants to play this for all of us, so we're going to do it. It's called A Message from the Heart of God Tabor, God of the Mountains, Earth Gaia. And yes, the Colorado Mountain, Rocky Mountain High, here we go.
Mm-hmm. beloved hearts, who are held under the love of the Mother's presence. I am the one that is known as God Tabor, and I am truly grateful. Long have myself and those ascended ones that work along with me, long have we served your planet, unknown, unrecognized, unremembered by humankind. We have served your planet since before you arrived. We were called into duty approximately 300 years before the arrival of the I Am Starseed, 14 and a half million years ago, to finish the preparation. And once the planet had been placed in orbit, to create the ideal atmosphere that you blessed hearts could embody upon this planet. You knew of us. You know some of us now. There are 28 of us. And you knew us well, and you knew our relationship to your planet, to sustaining precious ingredients of life upon your planet that you could embody here. You knew our relationship with the physical sun, and you knew that we played a critical role in the relationship between the I Am Starseed, the angels that were here with you in the beginning, and the elemental beings. In what happened 12 and a half million years ago, as many of you have come to understand, in which you became something other than your destiny, it is in this time that Father Helios and Mother Vesta of our physical sun informed us that humankind would forget us for millions and millions of years, and that the love and all that is important for any being to receive back for their service to life would not come from the peoples of Earth, but come from the angelic hosts, and would come from the elemental beings that were driven underground, and from our ascended family above. And so it is that we have lived unknown. You know of some of the great brothers. You know of God Ares, and God Virgo, and God Maru. You perhaps know of the twin flame couple to the earth, the god and goddess of Himalaya. And we are all in service to your planet. Support the messenger's thumb at dear hearts. As I come to you this day, I regret that I cannot come and offer you ascended master guests, gifts, as my kind who live in the great dimensions of life. I do not have any gift to offer you. Rather, I come to you and I ask for your help. We have watched. We known as the gods of the earth We were here for 400,000 years before you. And we were part of creating what you perhaps have come to know as the Garden of Eden. That your planet existed. She was perfect when you arrived. So perfect. And when you arrived, the elemental beings, which are but legend to your memories, the angelic beings who have been forced to be invisible to you, all lived with you, and we all lived in concert with each other. We all knew that the role we had to provide, the service that we had to give. Those of us who've remained these 50 million years, you have not seen us because we live in your mountains. We cannot withstand even the great electronic shields that we have around our ascended garments that allow us to live in your octave. Is very difficult upon us. The war machines that humans have made, the collapsing of bombs upon this planet that destroy so much life. We retreat rather than being out on the surface of your planet, directing the great streams of light from the sun and the sacred fire that your earth would be so blessed when there is war and when there are bombs that descend from moving aircraft. We have to hunker down inside the depths of mountains. And tears flow from my ascended brothers for our ascended garments are so attuned to the physical body of your planet. We are so grateful that there is a small portion of humankind that has freed themselves from all that has betrayed your wondrous God-given natures. We are so grateful for all of you. And we know the days that are ahead of you. We know better than you do. You have some understanding to modern science. You have some understanding of the harm that has occurred in your oceans, the harm that has occurred in your upper atmosphere, and the harm that has occurred to life that was supposed to share life with you upon this planet. And so with this awareness, and you have become aware also, of the great Lord Michael, the great Archangel, and the great brother Saint Germain, who is providing so much sacred fire to the earth. So much of it we cannot use. There are so important events coming in your future. And it is important that the reserve of sacred fire, the violet flame and cosmic blue flame, that the great ones have hidden within the mountains for the future. It is so important that we do not touch that. And I come to you and I am asking, I beg your forgiveness. Because as a descended peak, we are supposed to offer you gifts. And we love to give. But I have no gift to give you except to promise you that we are part of the life of your planet. And we are part of helping you in the future to restore your planet. And all I can do this day is ask you, precious hearts, to use the will that Mother Akasha has given you. Because if Lord Michael, if Saint Germain and their legions of angels could give us more violet flames, more cosmic blue flames, we could intensify some of the purification. We could undo some of the harm. And we could take some of the infectious disease that is penetrating the body of human consciousness and the body of this planet. So I, Teba, ask for your help. I ask that you would reach to your presence, the I Am presence, and the infinite I Am. And I ask that you would command that Saint Germain and Archangel Michael be given limitless amounts of the sacred fire to give that to those of us who are simply known as the gods of the earth, that we may use this to help your planet, to stabilize her in these times of change. Will you consider? I thank you. I thank you. With all of my ascended heart, I thank you. I thank you with all of my heart. These are not my tears. They are the messenger's garment, recognizing my feelings and recognizing how much physical matter, your own physical bodies, physical substance, the physical kingdoms have suffered so greatly under the footprints of mankind's war. And last I say to you, there is not a day that we do not decree from the great mountains of earth that war will cease to be. And I thank you. Just remember, dear hearts, to call to the I Am presence of all humankind and to demand that Saint Germain and his legions, demand that Lord Michael and his legions of angels just give oceans of the sacred fire, unlimited amounts of the sacred fire to the gods of the earth, that we may use that to help your kingdoms, to stabilize your planet, and to remove the disease of the sinister force that is affecting the body of God. I thank you, beloved hearts. Thank you.
Okay, everybody, that was absolutely stunning. Thank you so much, Karen. Whew. I just feel the energies coming now. I wanted to just share with you all the song we played about You Are So Beautiful. It comes from the Peace Alliance, and that's a Unity Church group that puts this piece on. It's called Positive Spin, and that was one of them. And I just wanted to read the mission because it's so apropos to what we've already got here. It is an alliance of organizers and advocates taking the work of peace building from the margins of society into the centers of national discourse and policy priorities. And if that isn't Nasara law in action, I don't know what is. And that idea that that young lady that called Tom Hartman and said that we need a bunch of folks who are willing to just do one term in Congress so that they cannot be cajoled and bribed and you know, offered let's make a deal from these, lobbyists and gun lobbies and all of that. No, nothing to lose. Spend one term and make a difference, like that Peace Alliance mission says. Pass that around, and I just think it's just an awesome concept. And then there's also this other one. It's called the Meta Center for Nonviolence, and that's www.metacenter.org. By the way, it's www.thepeacealliance.org. Also, they have one studentalliance.org. So you can do that both. This one is the Meta Center for Nonviolence, Box 98, Petaluma, Petaluma, California, 94953. And like I said, the Meta, www.metacenter.org. They have a phone number too, 707-774-6299. And, you know, just take it down, 707-774-6299. You never know. You can actually get on Free Speech TV on this particular event and help them to make another positive spin. We've got lots of talent in here. Just don't think twice about what you might be able to do here. Okay, that being said, I think now we want to go to, let's do our brother on the TV, Mr. Lumumba. They killed him too here. Let's just honor our ones who have come before us and made such inroads. And we certainly are the ones that are to carry this peace building on. So here we go, Rama. Okay. Just talk to them for a minute while I get this queued up and keep your head down.
Come on. I have few words, oh my God.
Pretty amazing, huh?
Very awesome, amazing stuff. It is only about love and ever increasing. You get more beautiful every day.
Okay, everybody, here we go.
Here
in the United States, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, Chokwe Lumumba, has died from heart failure at the age of 66, less than a year after he was elected. A longtime black nationalist organizer and attorney, Lumumba has been called America's most revolutionary mayor. We'll discuss Lumumba's legacy and hear from him in his own words after headlines. A former Guantanamo prisoner who spent nearly 3 years in U.S. custody without charge has been arrested in Britain on accusations related to the conflict in Syria. Police say Mozam Beg is suspected of attending a terrorist training camp and, quote, facilitating terrorism overseas. Beg is director of the prisoner advocacy group CAGE. Earlier this month, he published an article about visiting Syria to probe reports of U.S. and British complicity in rendering terrorism suspects to the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. He also said his passport was seized last month, writing, quote, I am certain that the only reason I'm being continually harassed, something that began long before any visit to Syria, is because CAGE and I are at the forefront of investigations and assertions based on Harvard evidence that British governments, past and present, have been willfully complicit in torture, he said. CAGE released a statement expressing outrage at Beg's arrest, writing, quote, Mozam Beg is just the latest individual drawn by the humanitarian catastrophe in Syria who's been labeled a terrorist. The purpose is to intimidate and vilify the wider Muslim community so that they're prevented from delivering much-needed aid to the Syrian people, the statement said. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see our interviews with Mozam Beg after he was released from Guantanamo. Missouri has executed its fourth prisoner in 4 months. Michael Taylor was injected with the lethal drug pentobarbital following his conviction of the rape and murder of a 15-year-old girl. His attorneys had warned the drug purchased from an unnamed compound. I'm sorry, everybody. I leaned on the wrong thing. Okay, just a moment. Got to get back there. Why can't I get that off of there?
Sure.
I can't unmute. Compounding pharmacy could cause immense suffering. They had also questioned Missouri's practice of executing prisoners before appeals are exhausted. Late last month, Missouri executed Herbert Smalls just minutes before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on an appeal. A nuclear waste disposal site is set to reopen in New Mexico following an unexplained leak of radioactive material. The underground waste dump was shut down earlier this month after an air monitor detected radioactive contamination. On Monday, federal regulators reported slightly elevated levels of airborne radioactivity but said they did not pose a public threat. The mine is near Carlsbad, New Mexico. And the family of a man who died following an encounter with police outside an Oklahoma movie theater this month has released disturbing video of the incident. Cell phone video shot by the man's wife shows Luis Rodriguez lying face down with five police officers pressing on top of him, one of them holding down his head while his wife pleads with them.
Luis, are you okay? Luis! Luis, are you okay?
He's fine.
Why you came to all this? Please, tell me.
Nayira Rodriguez says police beat her husband before he died. Police say he was uncooperative when they questioned him about reports of a domestic dispute. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The city of Jackson, Mississippi, is grieving today following the sudden death of Mayor Chokwe Lumumba, less than a year after he was elected. He suffered from heart failure Tuesday. He was 66 years old. A longtime black nationalist organizer and attorney, Lumumba had been described as America's most revolutionary mayor. Working with the Malcolm X grassroots movement, Lumumba advocated
advocated for participatory democracy and the creation of new worker-run cooperatives in Jackson. Over the past four decades, Lumumba was deeply involved in numerous political and legal campaigns. As an attorney, his clients have included former Black Panther Assata Shakur, as well as her godson, the late hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur. As a political organizer, Lumumba served for years as vice president of the Republic of New Africa, an organization which advocated for an independent, predominantly black government in the southeastern United States and reparations for slavery. He also helped found the National Black Human Rights Coalition and the Malcolm X grassroots movement. In June, Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed Chokwe Lumumba just after he was elected. We began by asking him how he was able to win the mayoral election in a place like Jackson, Mississippi, given its history and his history as a radical activist in the black liberation struggle.
Thank you for having me, and shout out and thank you to your listening audience. I attribute the victory that we had to this last week to the people of Jackson, who were more than ready to have leadership that was forward-looking and ready to raise Jackson to a different level of development, ready to embrace the ideas that all government should do the most to protect the human rights of the people in that jurisdiction. And we were very pleased with the outcoming of people to vote, with their participation, and with their continued support. I'm now running for the mayor, and have, in fact, won the mayor of the city of Jackson, because I think it's necessary. We are a population here now in the need of a lot of development. Development is one of the roads to human rights and to the recognition of human rights, especially our economic human rights. And some of that development is going to take the kind of leadership and the kind of consistency that we had in the struggle for voting rights and other kinds of rights, which has been unique to our history.
Well, Chokwe Lumumba, I'm not sure that many people around the country understand the symbolic, the symbolism of Jackson, Mississippi, as a center of racism and racial oppression over centuries. The very name of the city was named after Andrew Jackson by the white settlers when Jackson in 1820 was able, as an Indian commissioner, to pressure the Choctaw Indians to give up 13 million acres of land and move to Oklahoma in the Treaty of Doak Stand. And that's why the white settlers named the city after Jackson, because of his success at ethnic cleansing. And then, of course, it's history throughout through slavery and Jim Crow. How did this change occur? How were you able to put this together, this coalition, to be elected, given your history as a radical and activist in the black liberation struggle?
I think it's a tribute to our consistency. It's a tribute to our refusal to say that we would bow to the oppression that was around us. It's a tremendous story of our people. You talked about Mega Evers, but the continuation since Mega Evers, fighting against oppression, fighting against economic oppression, fighting against the kinds of things which have surfaced in our decades, which are similar to the kinds of things you cite in the distant history of Jackson. We have been persistent, and with that persistency, our people now are ready to move to a different level of development. And I should say that people should take a note of Jackson, because we have suffered some of the worst kinds of abuses in history, but we're about to make some advances and some strides in the development of human rights and the protection of human rights that I think have not been seen in other parts of the country. And I want to caution folks that we got to be careful now when we talk about any one particular place. In the United States, all over, we've seen intense oppression. I'm from Detroit initially, and we've seen a lot of oppression there historically as well as currently. New York has certainly seen its share. Washington, D.C. has seen its share. So we don't want to be like people on different plantations arguing about which plantation is worse. What we have to do is correct the whole problem, and we're about correcting the problem here in Jackson, and we're going to be inviting people to come here, and people want to come here in order to participate in this struggle forward. And this is not a phony struggle. We're not just putting a false face. We tell you we've had real problems. We still have some real problems, but we're solving these problems, and we're going to try to solve a lot of them through economic development, which is going to involve the masses of the people, not just a few folks.
Can you tell us about your platform and the Jackson-Cush plan?
Well, the platform is to advance the ideas of development and to advance the ideas of empowerment of the populations which exist in the city of Jackson specifically. We have a population, a demographic here, 80% of the population is black, about 20% is white, and we have Rufus brothers and sisters who are East Indian origin, as well as some Asian and some Hispanic folks coming in. Our slogan was one city, one aim, one destiny. And the idea is to blend these populations into a struggle forward. There are some people historically who have always tried to separate the populations and to have a certain portion of the population oppress the rest of the population. We're not going to tolerate that. We're going to move ahead. We're going to let everyone participate in this movement forward. We're going to invite everyone to participate in this movement forward. And we have formed like a people's assembly. That's key to what we've done here, where we have every 3 months the population can come out and participate in open forum to say what's on their mind. They can come out and learn some of the problems that the city is facing and some of the solutions that some of the problem solvers are supposed to be offering. And this will bring about more public education and political education to the population of the city, make our population more prepared to be motivated and organized in order to participate in the changes which must occur in the city of Jackson in order to move it forward. We say the people must decide. Educate, motivate, organize. That's the slogan we use, right?
The late Chokwe Lumumba, speaking on Democracy Now! On June 6th. He was elected mayor on June 5th, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. We're joined right now by three guests to talk about his shocking death, but also his life and his legacy. We're going to begin with Akinyele Umoja. He's an associate professor and chair of the Department of African American Studies at Georgia State University, a founding member, like Chokwe Lumumba, of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and the New African People's Organization. He's author of the book, We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. He's joining us from Los Angeles, and we're going to be going to Jackson, Mississippi, as well as speak with the former head of the NAACP, Ben Jealous, on the phone. But let's go first to his longtime ally. We're joined right now by Akinyele Umoja. Can you talk about his life and what you understand happened yesterday, his death?
Well, I'm in Los Angeles right now, so I can't give you a lot of details about his death. But in terms of his life, Chokwe Lumumba was born in 1948 in Detroit, Michigan. He grew up in a working class family. He was a second oldest child in that family. His mother, when he was a child, involved him in civil rights activity. Interestingly enough, they were raising money to go to Mississippi to support the movement of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and other groups in Mississippi. He became a student athlete. Chokwe was a very gifted athlete, went to Kalamazoo College, and there he became a student activist also. He was attracted to the Black Power movement, particularly after the assassination of Martin Luther King. You know, like a tremendous event occurred after the assassination of King. Many young Black people joined the Black Power movement, and Chokwe was attracted to a group in Detroit that was based in Detroit, the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, that demanded five states in the South, that also talked about creating a new society for Black people, a society where there would be diversity, a society that would have cooperative economic and socialistic principles. And those are things that Chokwe carried with him to his last days. He believed in Black self-determination. He believed that Black people should form and black people and other folks, because Chokwe was definitely an internationalist also, believed that there should be a new economic system that was more humanistic than the system we live in today. 1984, Chokwe helped found the New African People's Organization, which would be more activist than the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa. And then a companion with that in 1990 formed the Malcolm X grassroots movement. Chokwe was actually drafted to run for mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Many people, he'd been there, moved to Jackson in the late 80s, and he had been engaged in as an attorney, being an advocate for people, for workers' rights, being an advocate for victims of police brutality. He had challenged activity of the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist organizations in Mississippi. And because of his consistency of work in the state, many people said he should run for mayor. And the Malcolm X grassroots movement agreed with that, encouraged Chokwe to run, but decided to organize a different type of black politics there. We felt the traditional black politics weren't really working for us at this time. So in Chokwe's ward, first before he ran for mayor, in his ward when he ran for city councilman in 2009, a people's assembly was organized. And so when you heard the clip, him saying the people will decide, that slogan was put into practice by organizing an assembly that would develop his platform. So his platform actually came from the community and not out of his head or not out of our organization. Chokwe, they formed this people's assembly that helped him get elected, formed his platform, but also stayed organized while he was serving in city council to provide him with direction on how he should proceed on policy. So it was a different form of politics that was being pursued, as you mentioned earlier, encouraging participatory democracy, encouraging people to get active and also to become politically educated. The hope was, and the hope is still, after his election for mayor, that we would organize a people's assembly. And in fact, this May 2nd through 4th in Jackson, Mississippi. There'll also be the New Economies Conference, Jackson Rising Conference, to look at new economies, cooperative economic development, things of that nature. In the legacy of Chokwe Lumumba, we have to continue these initiatives, even though his untimely death. He died of a sudden heart attack. And our prayers go out to his family.
We're talking to Kenyele Omoja, who is Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of African American Studies at Georgia State University, a longtime friend and ally of Chokwe Lumumba, who died suddenly yesterday, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. When we come back, we'll also go to Jackson, Mississippi, and speak to people around the country. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a moment.
Springing in spirit, soul and mind, each day brings more joy.
Kiba here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about the sudden death of Chokwe Lumumba yesterday in Jackson, Mississippi. He was voted the mayor of, he was elected mayor in June of 2013. Chokwe Lumumba was born Edwin Finley Taliaferro. He told the Jackson Free Press why he chose his name. He said, "I picked the name Chokwe because in my African history class, I learned that the Chokwe tribe, which is a tribe that still exists, was one of the last tribes to resist the slave trade successfully in northeast Angola. The name literally means hunter. The second name, Lumumba, was the name of a great African leader who began to lead Africa to decolonize, to independence. He was from the Congo. Lumumba means gifted, so literally it means gifted hunter." I want to go back to Akinyele Umoja, associate professor and chair of the Department of Africa. African American Studies at Georgia State University, and founding member, like Chokwe Lumumba was, of the Malcolm X grassroots movement. The significance of the mayor's name, the late mayor's name.
Well, Chokwe, he, as you mentioned, was a black nationalist. He was inspired by Malcolm X. And Malcolm X talked to us about the legacy of the names that we were born with in this country, of having a legacy that was connected to slavery. And so Chokwe very much embraced the necessity of black people having a culture that was liberating. And in that context, and many people who are part of the New African movement with Chokwe began to change, like myself, to change their names to African names to try to embrace that heritage. But not only looking back, but also looking forward to try to develop new societies and new communities and to be able to give our children a legacy that's connected to a liberation movement as opposed to a legacy that was connected to slavery. And so he very much believed that, for instance, one of the major issues, as we talked about Jackson, he felt that the curriculum needed to be changed in the schools to be able to give our children more knowledge of their history and heritage. He felt that was connected to low academic achievement in Mississippi, which, you know, generally rates in one of the lowest achieving school systems in the country. And so he believed in that. I also want to point out that Chokwe was an internationalist. One of the last times we spent extensive time together, we were in Haiti. I know, Amy, you've covered the fight for democracy in Haiti.
Right.
And we went there in 2010 to examine what was going on after the earthquake. And we found at that time, and Chokwe and I both held a press conference in Port-au-Prince, looking at that many of the funds that had been collected for people who abused and were victims of the earthquake hadn't been distributed to them. We also called for the return of President Aristide. So Chokwe, and this is just one example of the campaigns around the world or issues around the world that Chokwe began to speak about and speak on, as well as his support for human rights for people who had immigrated to Jackson and other parts of the United States from other countries and the rights that they had. He was very much opposed to the legislation that was occurring in Arizona and in the state I live in Georgia that racially profiled immigrants. So he was a champion. I mentioned he was a black nationalist. He's also an internationalist who campaigned for human rights for all people.
Professor Umoja, we're also joined by Bill Chandler, a close ally of Mayor Lumumba, was a member of his transition team. Bill Chandler is also a veteran of the civil rights struggles in Mississippi and is founding executive director of the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance, where Lumumba served as legal counsel before he became mayor. I know Jackson, Mississippi is mourning right now, Bill. Our condolences to all of you. Can you talk about what Mayor Lumumba was pushing forward before his unexpected death yesterday?
Well, I think both of us came to Jackson, Mississippi with the same goal in mind, and that is the realization that in the South, this is where change is going to occur that's going to affect our country and move it in a more progressive direction. I started with organizing public workers. Choque was involved in supporting that effort in Mississippi. There is now a state employees union, and also workers for the city of Jackson have organized and are in the process of renegotiating a new contract with the city of Jackson. Further, we recognize that with the in-migration of immigrants from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America and Mexico into Mississippi, that it would create a possibility of significant political change here. And many of the things that Choque was fighting for were the same things that we were fighting for. So 13 years ago, when we formed the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance, we did it with unions and churches and civil rights organizations coming together, and Choque became our council. We worked together on many issues related to the human rights struggle. You know, for example, the effort to free the Scott sisters, two young women that were arrested and sent up with life sentences for allegedly stealing $11. We worked together on other issues as well when he was attacked by a white supremacist judge in Durant, Mississippi. We joined in the effort to prevent him from being disbarred. We spent time on the picket lines in front of the Bar Association, among other things. But he was a strong supporter of immigrant rights, and I think almost every, in fact, every conference that we had in terms of unity, trying to build unity between immigrants, brown folks, and African Americans, he was part of the efforts to demonstrate the need for unity. And so it was a natural thing when he announced that he was running for city council that we would join with him in that effort that was very successful. And it was very much a grassroots movement here in Jackson. We spent a lot of time going door to door. We had house meetings and communities, and it was a very successful campaign. And one of the first things, basically following the example of the city of Detroit, where Councilman Kenneth Cockrell Jr. had initiated an ordinance to prevent racial profiling by public officials, we adopted that idea in Jackson, and together with the legal project director, Patricia Ice, who is of MIRA, who is also a native of Detroit, we crafted an ordinance that prohibited any public official in the city of Jackson from profiling racially or people that were immigrants in the city. And that really has created a foundation for an effort to make the city of Jackson a more welcoming community for immigrants as they come into Mississippi seeking refuge and seeking work here. And so we have worked together many times in really a constant relationship. And when the community basically encouraged him to run for mayor and in effect drafted for mayor, we joined his campaign with enthusiasm from the very beginning. And again, it was a people's campaign. We had the People's Assembly that developed in Ward 2, which he represented at the city council, began spreading throughout the city. And as a matter of fact, this Saturday we have planned to have a People's Assembly for the whole city to talk about the issues that people face here. So the loss of Choque Lumumba was very shocking to us here. I heard about it shortly after he had passed yesterday afternoon. And, you know, it's something that is very hard to take. And we extend our thoughts and our prayers to his family, who is very close in the community here, and we look forward to continuing his vision for the city of Jackson.
I want to talk more about the Scott sisters in Mississippi in January of 2011. Two African-American sisters were freed from life sentences in jail, as you mentioned, for an $11 armed robbery. The sisters, Gladys and Jamie Scott, had spent 16 years in prison. For $11. The NAACP and other civil rights groups had campaigned for years for their freedom. Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour suspended their sentences on condition that Gladys donate a kidney to her sister who is on dialysis.
You know, I'm praying to God that I am a match because I don't want her to have nobody else's kidney. I want her to have mine. Whether I was, you know, released because I had to give her a kidney. I was going to give it to her anyway if I could give it to her in prison. Didn't nobody have to release me because if they would have let me give it to her when she had kidney first failed, I would have gave it to her without a shadow of a doubt. I love my sister.
That was Gladys Scott. Her sister, 36-year-old Jamie Scott, reflected on how much the world had changed since they were sent to prison in 1994.
Last night, I didn't sleep at all last night. I see pictures of stuff in magazines, different things as the world's changing and everything. Cell phones, up-to-date cell phones and all these things. And today I don't use it, mostly everybody's cell phone that's with me. I just wanted to touch them and I've been playing with them and everything. And it's so amazing, you know, how the world has changed since 1994 and up to today. It's so amazing and I'm still trying to soak it all in.
That was Jamie Scott, and before that, Gladys Scott, released from jail after 16 years in prison for an $11 robbery. Standing next to them was Shoko Lumumba, their attorney at the time, now mayor, until yesterday. His sudden death is why we're talking about him today, though we interviewed him the day after he was elected. Also standing there was Ben Jealous, former president and CEO of the NAACP, who recently wrote a piece for the Huffington Post called Remembering Shoko Lumumba. Remember him for us, Ben.
Sure. Well, you know, that was the fourth or fifth time we had stood next to people that we had worked together to free from prison over the last 20 years. And that was what was so remarkable about Shokwe. I mean, you know, he was a man who was, you know, a true man, if you will. He was active in his church. He had a great marriage to his wife. He had two wonderful kids that he poured all of his love into. He was a well-respected coach. He was an incredible lawyer, and he chose his. And he also was, somebody with very strong ideals. And he chose to live and practice those ideals on the ground in one of the poorest places in our country. And he brought all of those things with him into the courtroom, all the compassion, all the insight, all the skill as a lawyer on behalf of the poorest people in the state. And that's ultimately what Bill and Jared Johnson, the president of the NAACP in Mississippi, and so many others, and say he was drafted to run for mayor because everybody had basically fallen over, put this way, an overwhelming majority of Jackson, I won't say everybody black, because there are definitely some people who are on the other side, but an overwhelming majority of Jackson, black and white, had fallen in love with Shokwe over the years that he had lived in town because he was just such a good person. And you knew in your heart when you live in Jackson that the toughest thing in Mississippi to be is to be poor and black and in court without good counsel. And he would, and oftentimes, risk to his own financial stability, defend anyone who he thought he could help, who he thought needed help, and most importantly, who he was convinced that nobody else would help.
I want to go back to our interview with Shokwe Lumumba on Democracy Now! The day after he was elected. We talked to him June 6th. I asked him about the FBI's decision last year to place his former client, Assata Shakur, on the most wanted terrorist list. But before we play that clip, I wanted to ask you, Ben, about the media coverage, both of Shokwe Lumumba, his election, and the significance of the man who some call the most revolutionary mayor in America, the lack of the coverage. Last night, I was watching the networks, and I opened the New York Times today, the actual paper edition, and I didn't see a reference. Last night, watching MSNBC for hours. Now, I didn't watch every single second, so I might have missed something. But I did not see a reference. As Bill Chandler said, he died late yesterday afternoon.
Yeah. So, you know, I know that I saw something in the Times this morning online.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Shokley is somebody who you have to give this much time to really talk about. This is a man who lived, if you will, sort of multiple journeys in his life, and who was quixotic to people because, on the one hand, you could easily stereotype him as being some sort of radical. He would say he was a radical because he didn't see that as being a bad thing. You know, he was somebody who thought that frankly, having ideals and practicing them in this country full of so much hypocrisy was a radical thing. But he was also somebody who was extremely committed mayor, very good at working across the aisle, even in his short tenure, with people in the business community, in the most conservative corners of the city, if you will. And he was somebody who, at the end of the day, yes, stood up for black people, but was ultimately committed to fairness for everyone in our country. And so, you know, for I think many in the media who sort of deal in sound bites, there's just too much there to quickly understand in 30 seconds, and so they move on. But he's ultimately the type of person that we need to understand better in our country, because our country ultimately is greatest, if you will, because of the contributions of idealists over the years who, yes, may have staked a far-out position at times in their lives, but ultimately served to pull our country closer to its own closely held ideals of fairness and equality and justice and the universal dignity of all humanity.
So let's go to that clip right now. When Shokwe Lumumba came on Democracy Now!, Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed him, and I asked Mayor Lumumba, well, he was mayor-elect at the time, about the FBI's decision to place his former client, Assata Shakur, who's in Cuba, on the most wanted terrorist list.
Well, I've always felt that Assata Shakur was wrongfully convicted, so she shouldn't be on a wanted list at all. She never should have been in prison. She was actually shot herself and wounded and paralyzed at the time that the person whom she was convicted of killing was shot. So she obviously couldn't have shot him. And she also was arrested, which caused the incident, for about 8 different charges, which she later was found not guilty of or were dismissed. So I think it's unfortunate. Assata Shakur, I believe, will historically be proven to be a hero of our times.
That was Shokwe Lumumba on Democracy Now! On June 6th. Akinyele Emoja, can you talk more about his representation of Assata Shakur and others, the significance of this man, this radical attorney, black nationalist, becoming the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, and now his loss as we wrap up?
Well, Shokwe was an excellent attorney. In fact, he went to law school inspired by the need for attorneys for people who had been political prisoners, such as Assata Shakur. He went to Wayne State Law School, and then after he went to Wayne State, he successfully sued Wayne State for discrimination against African-American students there. And then he began to dedicate himself to defending, not only, as was mentioned before, the poorest of our community and victims of police brutality, victims of worker, people who had been fighting for their rights as workers and had been unjustly fired or whatever. But he also took on the cases of victims of COINTELPRO, or people who had been targeted by J. Edgar Hoover's counterinsurgency program, a war against the Black Freedom Movement of the 1960s and 70s. So Assata was one of those people. In fact, in the case he had with Assata, the case was dismissed. He also was a co-counsel, the case of Geronimo Gijago, or also known as Geronimo Pratt, who was another person targeted by COINTELPRO. Dr. Mutulu Shakur, and Sekou Odinga, who were charged with freeing Assata Shakur from prison in 1979. So he handled the cases that maybe others would shy away from. He definitely believed, and even though Shokwe did believe in humanity and love all humanity, he did believe that the United States government was unjust government was a government that had a legacy of committing crimes against black people and other people of color and other oppressed people in the United States. And so he was committed to, as an attorney, and he was committed as an activist to try to have self-determination and a new system of social justice. Tshokwe, even though he ran for mayor and he believed in working, using every opportunity we had within the system to try to govern ourselves and use whatever influence we had inside of government to improve the lives of people, he did still believe that we needed more fundamental change, that we needed more more systemic change.
In terms of where the city of Jackson goes right now, we're going to end with a guest who just showed up in Jackson, Mississippi, in the studio, but he didn't just show up in Jackson, though he did travel there to be with Tshokwe Lumumba as he became mayor of the city. Kwame Kenyatta is with us, the former Detroit city councilman who moved to Jackson last year to serve as Mayor Lumumba, Mayor Lumumba's contract compliance officer. My condolences to the city of Jackson. This is a loss to the country. Kwame Kenyatta, as we wrap up this discussion, you're coming in just on the tail end. Hold forth. Tell us the significance of your colleague, your friend, Tshokwe Lumumba, and what this loss means for the direction the city of Jackson was going in.
Well, it is a tremendous loss for the city of Jackson, the state of Mississippi, indeed the country and the world. As you know, Brother Tshokwe was a human rights activist, attorney who fought for the liberation of all people, but definitely fought for the liberation of people of African descent here and around the world. He had developed a strategy to bring this city back. And as he said, not just Jackson, but Mississippi as a whole, who has a history that's not a very good history of treating people in the right manner. So we had just won a 1% sales tax that would build up our infrastructure. The president is talking about building infrastructure. Brother Tshokwe had moved to do just that. That sales tax go into effect this Saturday. With that, he intended to build new homes, new businesses, new institutions that would help the people. We live in a state that has the
That's amazing, actually. He increased the taxes and had the support of the city to do that. It is a lesson to people all over the country about what is possible if that money is going back into shoring up the city.
Raised the water rates and as well as the taxes, and people understood that it was necessary in order that, but that was because they had faith in his vision. They had faith in what he stood for all of his life and what he stands for now. And so with that, they were willing to bite the bullet to make this place a better place to live.
You said, Kwame Kenyatta, you were just about to say this is a city with the highest, and I cut you off.
Well, we have a state that is the highest, the poorest state in the country. It is the most obese state in the country, and just recently found to be on the bottom when it comes to education. All of these things was in the mind of Brother Tshokwe Lumumba as to how we can improve the quality of life here in Jackson. He could have lived anywhere, but he believed in the vision that the movement put forth years ago, the Malcolm X doctrine, that we must organize upon the land and organize the people upon that land. And he did just that. He gave up his home in Detroit to come here to one of the five states to begin to organize. He never wavered on that. He never faltered on that. He was committed to that to the end. His last call was a call about a meeting that I was in, and he wanted to know what the outcome of that meeting was. And so even in his hospital room, minutes before he died, he was working and doing the work of the people.
Kwame Kenyatta, I want to thank you for being with us, as well as all of our guests. The former Detroit City Council member who moved to Jackson to be with the new mayor at the time in June, Chokwe Lumumba. Kwame Kenyatta, thanks for joining us. Akinyele Omoja, thank you for being with us. Bill Chandler and Ben Jealous. Again, the shocking news that the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, has died. He died late yesterday afternoon. It was reported of heart failure.
Okay, everybody, we're going to do something that's really important next. This is called Inner Worlds, Outer Worlds. It brings tears to my heart and my eyes everywhere. These are two gentlemen, this Mr. Bill Hicks. They killed him at 32 years old. And then our brother here was 66. He was the same age as I am, but they killed him. And we must go forward. And we have been left a legacy that is so rich. So this is Inner Worlds, Outer Worlds. This is part two, The Spiral. Here we go. This is kind of an educational meditation, both and.
The Pythagorean philosopher Plato hinted enigmatically that there was a golden key that unified all of the mysteries of the universe. It is this golden key that we will return to time and again throughout our exploration. The golden key is the intelligence of the Logos, the source of the primordial Om. One could say that it is the mind of God. With our limited senses, we are observing only the outer manifestation of the hidden mechanics of self-similarity. The source of this divine symmetry is the greatest mystery of our existence. Many of history's monumental thinkers, such as Pythagoras, Kepler, Leonardo da Vinci, Tesla, and Einstein, have come to the threshold of the mystery. Einstein said, "The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. We are in the position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many different languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It does not know how. It does not understand the languages in which they are written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent human being toward God. We see a universe marvelously arranged and obeying certain laws. Our limited minds cannot grasp the mysterious force that moves the constellations. Every scientist who looks deeply into the universe, and every mystic who looks deeply within the self, eventually comes face to face with the same thing. The primordial spiral. A thousand years before the creation of the ancient observatory at Stonehenge, the spiral was a predominant symbol on Earth. Ancient spirals can be found in all parts of the globe. Thousands of ancient spirals such as these can be found all over Europe, North America and New Mexico, Utah, Australia, China, Russia, virtually every indigenous culture on Earth. The ancient spirals symbolize growth, expansion, and cosmic energy,
embodied within the sun and the heavens. The spiral form is mirroring the macrocosm of the unfolding universe itself. In Native traditions, the spiral was the energetic source, the primordial mother. The Neolithic spirals at Newgrange, Ireland date back 5,000 years. They are 500 years older than the Great Pyramid of Giza, and they are just as enigmatic to modern observers. The spiral goes back to a time in history when humans were more connected to the Earth, to the cycles and spirals of nature, a time when humans were less identified with thoughts. The spiral is what we perceive to be the torque of the universe. Prana, or creative force, swirls Akasha into a continuum of solid forms. Found at all levels between the macrocosm and the microcosm, from spiral galaxies to weather systems, to the water in your bathtub, to your DNA, to the direct experience of your own energy. The primordial spiral is not an idea, but rather that which makes all conditions and ideas possible. Various types of spirals and helices are found throughout the natural world. Snails. Sea coral. Spider webs. Fossils. Seahorses' tails. And shells. Many spirals appearing in nature are observable as logarithmic spirals or growth spirals. As you move out from the center, the spiral sections get exponentially larger, like Indra's net of jewels. Logarithmic spirals are self-similar or holographic, such that the characteristics of every part are reflected in the whole. 2,400 years ago in ancient Greece, Plato considered continuous geometric proportion to be the most profound cosmic bond. The golden ratio, or divine proportion, was nature's greatest secret. The golden ratio can be expressed as the ratio of A plus B to A is the same as the ratio of A to B. To Plato, the world's soul binds together into one harmonic resonance. The same pentagonal pattern that exists in a starfish or in a slice of okra can be seen in the path of the planet Venus, traced in the night sky over an 8-year period. The intelligible world of forms above and the visible world of material objects below through this principle of geometric self-similarity. From the self-similar spiral patterns of the Romanesco broccoli to the arms of galaxies, logarithmic spirals are a ubiquitous and archetypal pattern. Our own Milky Way galaxy has several spiral arms which are logarithmic spirals with a pitch of about 12 degrees. The greater the pitch of the spiral, the tighter the terms. When you observe a plant, growing in time-lapse video. You witness it dancing with the spiral of life. A golden spiral is a logarithmic spiral that grows outward by a factor of the golden ratio. The golden ratio is a special mathematical relationship that pops up over and over in nature. The pattern that is observable follows what is called the Fibonacci series, or Fibonacci sequence. The Fibonacci series unfolds such that each number is the sum of the previous two numbers. The German mathematician and astronomer Kepler discovered that self-similar spiral patterns are observable in the way leaves are arranged on stems of plants, or in the floret and petal arrangements of flowers. Leonardo da Vinci observed that the spacing of leaves was often in spiral patterns. These patterns are called phyllotaxis patterns, or leaf arrangement patterns. Phyllotaxis arrangements can be seen in self-organizing DNA nucleotides. And in everything from the family trees of reproducing rabbits to pine cones, cacti, to snowflakes and in simple organisms such as diatoms. Diatoms are one of the most common types of phytoplankton, single-celled organisms that provide food for countless species throughout the food chain. How much math do you need to know to be a sunflower or a bee? Nature doesn't consult the physics department to grow broccoli. The structuring in nature happens automatically. Scientists in the field of nanotechnology use the term self-assembly to describe the way complexes are formed, such as in the initial hexagonal phase of DNA formation. In nanotechnology engineering, carbon nanotubes are comprised of a similar arrangement of materials. Nature does this type of geometry over and over, effortlessly, automatically, without a calculator. Nature is precise and extremely efficient. According to the famous architect and author Buckminster Fuller, these patterns are a function of time-space. DNA and honeycomb are the shape that they are for the same reason a bubble is round. It is the most efficient shape, requiring the least amount of energy. Space itself has shape and allows only certain configurations for matter, always defaulting to what is most efficient. These patterns are the strongest and most efficient way to build architectural structures, such as geodesic domes. Logarithmic spiral patterns allow plants maximum exposure to insects for pollination. Maximum exposure to sunlight and rain, and allow them to efficiently spiral water towards their roots. Birds of prey use the logarithmic spiral pattern to stalk their next meal. Flying in a spiral is the most efficient way to hunt. One's ability to see the spiral of life dancing akasha into material form is related to one's ability to see beauty and symmetry in nature. poet William Blake said, "The vegetative universe opens like a flower from the Earth's center, in which is eternity. It expands from stars to the mundane shell, and there it meets eternity again, both within and without." The study of patterns in nature is not something that is very familiar in the West. But in ancient China, this science was known as Li. Li reflects the dynamic order and pattern in nature. But it is not pattern thought of as something static, frozen, or unchanging, like a mosaic. It is dynamic pattern as embodied in all living things. The arteries of leaves, the markings of the tortoise and the vein patterns on rocks are all expressions of nature's secret language and art. The labyrinth is one of many Li patterns. It is found in coral structures, mushrooms like the morel, cabbages, and in the human brain. The cellular pattern is another common form in nature. There are a myriad of different cellular structures, but all have a similar orderliness defined by their purpose and function. It is easy to be mesmerized with a constant play of forms. But what is most interesting is that certain archetypal forms seem to be woven into the fabric of nature at all. The branching pattern is another Li pattern, or archetypal pattern, that is observable at all levels and all fractal scales. For example, this incredible image of a supercomputer simulation known as the Millennium Run, showing the distribution of dark matter in the local universe. It was created by the Max Planck Society in Germany. Dark matter is essentially what we previously thought of as empty space. It is like an invisible nervous system that runs throughout the universe. The universe is literally like a giant brain. It is constantly thinking, using a type of dark or hidden energy that science is only starting to understand. Through this immense network, unfathomable energy moves, providing the momentum for the expansion and growth of the universe. Nature creates branching patterns automatically when we set up the right conditions. Nature is an art-generating machine, or a beauty-creating engine. Here, electricity is being used to grow silver crystal branches. The footage is time-lapsed as they grow over several hours. The crystals form on the aluminum cathode, as ions are electro-deposited from a silver nitrate solution. The formation is self-organizing. You are seeing artwork generated by nature itself. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe said, "Beauty is a manifestation of secret natural laws, which otherwise would have been hidden from us forever."
In this sense, everything in nature is alive, self-organizing. When higher voltage is used, the fractal branching becomes even more obvious. This is happening in real time. In the human body, tree-like structures and patterns are found throughout. There are, of course, the nervous systems that Western medicine knows about. But in Chinese, Ayurvedic, and Tibetan medicine, the energy meridians are a central component to understanding how the body functions. The nadis, or energy meridians, form tree-like structures. A post-mortem examination will not reveal the chakras or the nadis. But that does not mean they do not exist. You need to refine your tool that you use to look. You must first learn to quiet your own mind. Only then you will observe these things first within yourself. In electrical theory, the less resistance in a wire, the more easily it can carry energy. When you cultivate equanimity through meditation, it creates a state of non-resistance in your body. Prana, or chi, or inner energy, is simply your inner aliveness. What you feel when you bring your consciousness within the body. The subtle wires within your body that carry prana, the nadis, become able to move more and more pranic energy through the chakras. Your wiring becomes stronger as you use it, as you allow energy to flow. Wherever consciousness is placed, chi or energy will begin to flow and physical connections blossom. Within the brain and nervous system, physical wiring patterns become established by repetition. By continually placing your attention within and lowering resistance to the sensations you are experiencing, you increase your energetic capacity. In Taoism, the yin-yang symbol represents the interpenetration of the spiral forces of nature. The yin-yang is not two and not one. The ancient concept of the hara is represented by a yin-yang, or spiral swirl. It is the power center located in the belly below the navel. Hara means literally sea or ocean of energy. In China, the hara is called the lower dantian. In many forms of Asian martial arts, the warrior with strong hara is said to be unstoppable. In the samurai tradition, one form of ritual suicide, or seppuku, was hara kiri, was often mispronounced as hari kiri. It means to impale one's hara, thereby cutting off one's chi or energy channel. Moving from this center creates the grounded, graceful movement that you see not only in martial arts, but in great golfers, belly dancers, and Sufi whirling dervishes. It is the cultivation of single-pointed, disciplined consciousness that is the essence of hara, the stillness in the eye of the hurricane.
It is the gut instinct in connection to one's energy source. A person with good hara is connected to the earth and to the intuitive wisdom that connects all beings. To think with your belly, hara dikenganase, is to tap into your inner wisdom. The ancient Australian Aborigines concentrated on the same area, just below the navel, where the cord of the great rainbow serpent lay coiled. Again, a representation of the evolutionary energy in humankind. It is no accident that it is in the hara where new life begins. The enteric nervous system, sometimes referred to as the gut brain, is capable of maintaining a complex matrix of connections similar to the brain in the head, with its own neurons and neurotransmitters. It can act autonomously, that is, with its own intelligence. You could say that the gut brain is a fractal version of the head brain, or perhaps the head brain is a fractal version of the gut brain. A healthy bear has strong hara. When a bear knows where to forage for herbs, it follows the movement of chi through its senses, centered in the hara or belly. This is the bear's connection to the dream lodge, the place in native traditions where all knowledge comes from, to the spiral of life. But how did ancient peoples know about the spiral, if modern science is just now starting to recognize its significance? Ask the bees, for they have not forgotten how to love. Bees have a special connection to the source, as part of a symbiotic system, helping beauty and diversity to flourish. They are a bridge between the macrocosm and the microcosm. There is one heart that connects all, a hive mind, if you will. Like an open brain, the hive sends out its dreams into the world to be manifested. In nature, many creatures know how to act in unison, to move with one spirit, one direction. Benefit the other species around them. For example, the locust will devour everything in its path. A locust has no choice but to act like a locust. It will never make honey or pollinate plants the way a bee does. A locust's behavior is rigid, but a human is unique in that we can act like a bee or we can act like a locust. We are free to change and manipulate the patterns of how we interact with the world. We can exist symbiotically or as a parasite. Today, humans try to understand the spiral with the rational mind. But it was never thinking that connected us to the spiral of life.
What's in there?
We have always been connected. Thinking has been what keeps us in the illusion of separateness within our own identities. Thinking is the creation of separateness, the experience of limitation. The more we align with thought, the more removed we become from the source. Ancient cultures that were less thought-oriented aligned themselves with the spiral in a more direct and personal way than we do today. In ancient India, Kundalini is a representation of one's inner energy, which moves in snake-like or helix-like pattern up the spine. In the ancient yogic traditions of India, the inner worlds of people at that time were comparable to those of Hara-centered cultures. To balance the power of the spiral with the stillness of your witnessing consciousness is to align with your full evolutionary potential, to blossom into the unique multifaceted being you were designed to be. Ida, the feminine or moon channel, is connected to the right brain, and Pingala, the masculine or sun channel, connected to the left brain. When these two channels are in balance, energy flows up a third channel, Sushumna, along the center of the spine, energizing the chakras and unlocking one's full evolutionary potential. The word chakra is an ancient Sanskrit word meaning energy wheel. Kundalini is nothing less than the primordial spiral that dances your human life into existence. It is a different order of energy than we normally understand, like a bridge from gross matter to the most subtle energies. You are that bridge. Kundalini is not energy that can be forced by will, effort, and friction. It is analogous to growing a flower. All we can do as good gardeners is prepare the soil in proper conditions and let nature take its course. If you force a flower to open prematurely, you will destroy it. It grows with its own intelligence, with its own self-organizing direction. The egoic mind, which fixates on the outer world, is what keeps you from experiencing your true inner vibratory nature. When consciousness is turned within, it becomes like the sun's rays, and the lotus within begins to grow. As Kundalini awakens within oneself, one begins to see the signature of the spiral in all things, in all patterns within and without. This spiral is the link between our inner worlds and our outer worlds.
Takuyasin. That was well done. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. What a good way to start March 1st, everybody. Okay, let's shift our gears now. We're going to go to episode 569. And here comes Max Kaiser. And he's going to dissect this Bitcoin charade that went down here. And I'm just going to tell you, the King of Swords said this will be back with balls on. Bitcoin is not going anywhere. So let's see what happened. Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know, the CEO of Mt. Gox tried to concern troll his way into a bailout, just like Hank Paulson trolling Congress in 2008. Mark Karpeles told other Bitcoin firms that he was really also very concerned that if they didn't bail him out to the tune of 200,000 Bitcoin, then Bitcoin would collapse. Of course, when Treasury Secretary ex-Goldman Sachs man Hank Paulson did the same, Congress and shrieking voters gave him what he wanted. For markets had tumbled by nearly 1,000 points. Wah! Yes, we're big babies. Stop it, they cried. So, Mark, now that you have bankrupted the Magic Gathering online exchange and allegedly disappeared with your customers' money in the style of John Corzine of MF Global infamy, and now that U.S. federal prosecutors have subpoenaed you, it's time to get a job on Wall Street. That's where too-big-to-fail crybabies operate. Bitcoin is no place for babies. Stacey.
Yes, Max. Well, allegedly, although this is allegedly, Mark Karpeles at Mt. Gox has lost or misplaced or you know, stolen 744,000 Bitcoin. And again, we're pre-recording this a bit, so we don't know if he's jumped from some tall building in Tokyo yet. But at the time of the recording, he has not yet jumped. Now, that 744,000 Bitcoin is about 6% of all Bitcoin out there. But did you know that 3% of Chinese GDP per year is also stolen, taken out of the country, and brought to Australia, the UK, Canada, and America? Corrupt Chinese officials flee overseas, some bound for Australia. So apparently there's an intensifying crackdown on corruption in China, so they're all fleeing. And the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, a prestigious government-controlled think tank, urged stricter monitoring of what it termed naked officials, those whose spouses or children have migrated overseas and were therefore more likely potential recipients of illicit funds from within China. The phenomenon of the flight of officials is likely to escalate, particularly under the current anti-graft wave, said Liu Yanbin, a researcher at the Academy and co-author of the report. Corrupt cadres are running out of places to live in this country.
Right, so 3% of China's GDP is being extracted by these corrupt officials fleeing. What percentage of the U.S. GDP is tied to these two big defaults on Wall Street that are being bailed out and disrupting their economy? I think it's something like 22%. So a mere 6% of the Bitcoin economy being in question due to the machinations of Mark Karpeles over there in Tokyo, it's part and parcel of what you see in markets. The point being, though, that he's established himself as a totally corrupt guy. Therefore, he should be working on Wall Street, not in the Bitcoin space, because Bitcoin is free market capitalism. It's not crony capitalism. It's not too big to fail capitalism. He tried to emulate Hank Paulson by extorting a bailout fee from other Bitcoin firms. So he's clearly on the wrong side of the crypto divide. He should be in fiat world, not in crypto world.
Well, at one point, that 744,000 Bitcoins was worth close to $1 billion. Right now, it's worth like $400 million. But, you know, there's a place for, if you can steal and loot that much from any economy, there's a place for you, as they point out here, for these Chinese officials. Past experience shows that the most popular destinations for corrupt officials are the U.S., Canada, and Australia, said Hu Jingdao, an economics professor at the Beijing Institute of Technology. Australia has already become a major recipient country of Chinese corrupt officials. Now, Australia is changing their visa system because there were so many Chinese. There were literally tens of thousands of them on this list, on this visa application list, for one of the top visa applications there, the visa categories. And instead, because there were so many, they reckon they could charge them like $2.5 million Australian dollars instead of the, I don't know, the tens of thousands they were charging previously.
Well, this is inflation. People say there's no inflation, but this is inflation. The central banks are printing lots of money, and it's going into Chinese visa applicants, whose price for coming into the UK is going from 1 million to 2 million, soon to be 5 million pounds. Why do they want to come here? They want to come here to launder the money they're stealing from China. When they arrive here, they use all the laundered money given to them through the central banking system to jack up real estate prices in London, and everyone else who's actually working for a living, like firemen, policemen, school teachers, doctors, they have to move out of London to make room for the kleptocrats, and that's where the inflation is creating a problem in the economy.
Well, that's where you have housing bubbles, the countries they mention, Australia, Canada. Think of the Vancouver house prices. Again, a lot of those are also bought by Chinese. They could be fleeing. Now, they said, you know, that it was the Boston Consulting Group who said that 3% of annual GDP every year is taken from the country, smuggled out by these corrupt officials, the naked officials. Now, the actual numbers are quite amazing. They say a previous report from the CAS said more than 18,000 officials had fled the country between 1995 and 2008, smuggling out assets totaling 800 billion yuan, which is $145 billion. In 1 week alone last year, the state-run Economic Observer newspaper reported that 714 government officials fled overseas and did not return.
Again, this is inflationary. The people who are being destroyed by this inflation are dying, and the government is pointing to the people dying on the street and saying, you see, that's deflation, so we need to keep interest rates low. They don't bother looking at the fact that on the top end, due to mass migration of billionaires, it's causing incredible inflation that's bankrupting and destroying everyone else who's not in the kleptocrats class. But the bankers only look at the people who are the victims of the kleptocracy and say, you see, there's deflation. Let's keep interest rates low. They've put the blinders on and they don't look anywhere else in the economy where hyperinflation of visas going from 1 million pounds to 3 million pounds in 24 months, that doesn't seem to factor into their calculations. Why they should raise interest rates, not make visa applicants higher, because all you're doing is you're feeding the kleptocracy and you're continuing to create economic victims.
Now, Mark Karpeles did issue a statement claiming he was still in Tokyo. So we don't know if he's actually fled to Australia, Canada, or the U.S. under one of these visa programs with all his looted Bitcoin. But the actual Chinese themselves, who are victims of these corrupt officials, well, Mt. Gox exchange shutdown sparks Chinese Bitcoin gold rush. Chinese investors rushed to buy Bitcoin. Max, we were watching that on fiatleak.com, actually. You could just see voo, 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 all the Bitcoin going straight into China. Well, since Tuesday, more than 30,000 Bitcoins have changed hands in China. That's four times the usual trade volume in comparison with just 300 exchanged in the United States.
Right. Mark Karpeles is the John Corzine of the Bitcoin world. He made a terrible bet on Bitcoin. Had he been able to hold his position, it would have been very profitable for him. But like John Corzine and his position in Eurobonds, the timing was bad. He ended up bankrupting MF Global. He did eventually get a stay of execution from Goldman Sachs and his friends in Washington because they can print all the fiat money they want to cover all the crimes that are being committed. But Bitcoin cannot be printed to cover up the crimes. So like real market, free market capitalism, this guy's going to have to actually face the music.
Well, exactly. Everybody's saying, well, there should be regulation. But now you compare it to John Corzine, just like Mark Karpeles, they actually made really excellent, wicked, cool bets. They made sure bets. But they both dipped into client funds. They both dipped into client funds to cover their losses. Now, John Corzine, despite all of the regulation, despite everything that happened post-Enron, where CEOs are supposed to know what's going on with their books, he pleaded ignorance. He said, I'm just stupid. I didn't know that this was going on, and he got out of jail free. Well, people are saying Mark Karpeles should have known. He apparently never audited his books once, they say, in the last 3 years. So he's alleging he's as stupid as John Corzine.
Well, in free market capitalist economies, you have something called the price signal. And under John Corzine, the price signal of the bond market was manipulated by his folks and friends in the various bankers around the world to make it look like there wasn't this massive fraud going on. In the case of free market capitalism of Bitcoin, the price signal of Bitcoin dropping 50% from a high tells us that there's in fact something going on that needs to be looked at. And now it's being looked at, and the dead wood is being cleaned out of the Bitcoin economy. You know, people who say that Bitcoin is not regulated are that's false. The Bitcoin is the most regulated currency in the world. It's called the Bitcoin Protocol. That's the regulation. It disintermediates and it gets rid of the need for the CFO or the Serious Fraud Office or the SEC or anyone else, FinRENs, FinCEN. You don't need them because it's self-regulating in the truest sense of the word. It's like the equation E equals MC squared. There's nothing you can do to perfect it. It is what it is. It was discovered, and that's what it is. You don't need a regulator to come in and say, we need to regulate E equals MC squared. Similarly, with the Bitcoin protocol, there's nothing any regulator can do to add or subtract from the fact of the protocol what it is. That's what it is.
So we were talking about China and the corruption there. There were 41 new billionaires created last year. They're only second to the United States, where there were 72 billion new billionaires created. So I want to talk about corruption in the United States, because everybody, the U.S. is the global police force, right? Well, political connections in turbulent times. In a seminal 2001 paper, Ray Fisman mapped out the connections of various Indonesian companies to then-President Suharto and showed that the market value of those companies varied relative to the value of otherwise similar companies as rumors spread about Suharto's health. So they're like, ha-ha, that's a banana republic. They're corrupt. Well, they've just done a study looking at the United States, in particular, those bankers, in particular, connected very strongly to Tim Geithner. And what they found, over the 10 trading days following the announcement of Tim Geithner as Treasury Secretary, financial firms with a connection to Geithner experienced a cumulative abnormal return of about 12% relative to other financial sector firms. This reversed when his nomination ran into trouble due to unexpected tax issues. So the same corruption clearly is being priced in, the price signals as saying that it is a corrupt nation.
The U.S. is the easiest place for billionaires and dictators to launder money. Why? Because it's the only country in the world where you can have anonymous corporations. A lot of Americans create entities overseas, and then those entities create anonymous corporations in America so that they launder their money in America. General Electric, they made billions of dollars in revenues. They paid less than $20 million in taxes last year because of massive fraud, because America is the easiest place to commit massive fraud. And the same thing with pretty much the entire S&P 500. But anyway, we're out of time. We'll have to pick this up next time. Thanks so much.
Okay, Max.
Stay right there. Much more coming your way.
In 2010, one of the first things released by WikiLeaks was a secret video recording that actually looked like a video game, showing two American Apache helicopters opening fire on a dozen.
Yeah, just go ahead. Go ahead. Oops. No, go ahead some more. There. Right there. Right there.
Okay.
No, I'm down there.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know, the CEO of Mt. Gox tried to concern troll his way into a bailout, just like Hank Paulson trolling Congress in 2008. Mark Karpeles told other Bitcoin firms that he was really also very concerned that if they didn't bail him out to the tune of 200,000 Bitcoin.
Sorry, everybody. We didn't get it started the proper way. Oh, dear. Okay, go ahead and do it, honey. Pull it forward. One more. There, right there.
I said, the thing about Bitcoin is it's to a degree self-regulated. Mm-hmm. The algorithm, the protocol, is the regulation. So my example was E equals MC squared. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, a regulator can come in and say, well, maybe that isn't what it means. They can have no effect on it. It is what it is. The Bitcoin protocol, it's self-regulating. It's the protocol. It doesn't matter what any regulator says. Is that a fair statement?
Well, yes. Yes and no. So it's a fair statement when you stay in crypto land. So as long as you're within the Bitcoin blockchain, the digital spectrum, that's fine. The minute you want to touch the fiat world, you want to touch the actual currency world, then that's actually where they have a say. So the points of regulation where we're seeing it strongly happening are at the...
Oops. Oh, come on. How can you start it again? Oh. Just start it again.
to a degree self-regulated, the algorithm, the protocol is the regulation. So my example was E equals MC squared. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, a regulator can come in and say, well, maybe that isn't what it means. They can have no effect on it. It is what it is. The Bitcoin protocol, it's self-regulating. It's the protocol. It doesn't matter what any regulator says. Is that a fair statement?
Well, yes and no. So it's a fair statement when you stay in crypto land. So as long as you're within the Bitcoin blockchain, the digital spectrum, that's fine. The minute you want to touch the fiat world, you want to touch the actual currency world, then that's actually where they have a say. So the points of regulation where we're seeing it strongly happening are at the exchanges.
Right. This has always been kind of the membrane to separate the two worlds, and this is where they're going to focus in. Conceivably, crypto could eventually have its own ecosystem where it never touches fiat. I would imagine at some point.
Well, as long as you have to pay your taxes in fiat, there's always going to be a need for that money supply. But yeah, that's correct. More and more commerce can be done in the digital spectrum. And this is already being the case in places like Africa, for example, Kenya, where they transact with M-Pesa, they transact with other digital currencies. And so we'll probably see more proliferation where rule of law and currencies aren't quite stable.
Right, so it's almost like they're seceding from the fiat world. But I want to move on to Ethereum, because this is what we're here to talk about. So Ethereum, you know, we broke Bitcoin on this show. We were first to talk about it really in the world. We talked about Litecoin. We were the first to talk about Litecoin. Now I want to be the very first to talk about Ethereum, because this is really a huge new chapter in the whole crypto story. So give a little brief on it, if you can.
Yeah, sure. So Ethereum is really just a continuation of the experiment of cryptocurrencies. And so if we go back to the history of Bitcoin, there was two things that they were testing. They were testing a blockchain, so this idea of a decentralized database that everybody has a copy of. And the second thing was a transaction system with these tokens that you could send around. So effectively, it became email for money, and that's great. But then people said, well, we want all these other features. We want prediction markets. We want gambling. We want Wall Street. We want companies to live on a blockchain. We want law. And there's this endless amount of features that people could invent. So what we did at Ethereum is it's really a project of frustration. We took a step back and said, no features. Let's have a featureless Turing-complete blockchain, and let's go ahead and build kind of like the Android of the cryptocurrency space to sit on top of it, and let's make everything one-click installation. Your wallet, one-click, open transactions, one-click, Ripple, one-click, just go down the list. So that, in a nutshell, is basically Ethereum. It's this featureless thing where you can build your own features, you can build your own applications, and it kind of unifies the entire cryptocurrency space into one bucket.
So you've got the blockchain, and which is kind of the genius of Bitcoin.
Exactly.
And you've got, it's used as a payment system, mm-hmm. which is very fantastic.
It's an amazing
system. As you point out, every single transaction carries with it every transaction that's ever happened up until that point.
Right.
So you've got complete transparency. So what Ethereum says is that this blockchain can be used in another way.
In a more abstracted way. It can be used basically for anything. And I don't, as the designer, want to figure that out. Rather, what I'm going to do is give that to you. And I'm going to give that to everybody else in the ecosystem and say, you now have this beautiful foundation to build whatever you want to build on top of it.
Okay, here's the Thames River behind us.
Sure.
It's flowing through the city of London. There are now, that could be the blockchain, in other words. You know, this is the base of the crypto Bitcoin universe. All along the Thames are different ways people are accessing the Thames. There's a wharf there's a boat, there are
right.
buildings, there's commerce being done. So Ethereum is kind of plugging into the flow that is Bitcoin, the phenomenon that is Bitcoin, and allowing folks to build all kinds of things that are the word that came up when talking about Ethereum is efficiency.
Right.
So, and one of the ideas is that I had this, we were talking earlier, all of the financial contracts in the world can be broken down into 60 contracts, if the futures, options, brokerage.
Right.
So those 60 contracts, just talk a little bit about that, how that would work with Ethereum.
Oh, in terms of Willy Brommets, he's done some great work. So if people go to projectactus.org, Willy's working with MIT, and actually it's 30 contracts. And he took a look at everything, every financial relationship, and they're really like molecules in a sense. And you can actually break them down to more fundamental elements, these stated cash flows, basically. And so he looked at this and said, wow, this is really interesting. Can we actually try to replicate all of Wall Street from some base elements? And that's what Project Actus is doing. So what we're trying to do with Willy and trying to do with others is actually take those and port those and actually run those on Ethereum. And the goal is to actually take Wall Street and put it on blockchain. But this time it's transparent, it's fair, and it's not too big to fail.
So here you have Bitcoin as currency,
right.
which is giving central bankers and bankers the jitters, making them quite nervous, rightfully so.
Right.
Here you have on Ethereum a way to take my correction, 30 essential contracts that
right.
encompass the universe of financialization. and you're giving anyone, anywhere, the ability to simply plug into using Ethereum on the blockchain and potentially take companies public, create futures contracts, yes, create prediction markets, all for virtually no cost.
Exactly.
So everyone in that industry, Wall Street, City of London, is now, to use, you know, a word often uttered in the tech space, disintermediated, right? So they get kind of blown out in a sense.
They're new tools, and it depends on the existing incumbents to decide how they want to use these tools. But the point is that the tools we have today work for 2 billion people, and they work somewhat well, but they don't work for the whole world. And so the goal is, how do we build a tool set that's going to work for 7 billion people? And how do we build a tool set that's going to work fair for 7 billion people? So the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is it became the money of the internet. It's a fair money. No matter where you're at, it works the same. And the goal of Ethereum is kind of to become the internet of money. It's a whole bunch of different things, from contracts between people to contracts between properties, so we have smart property, to even organizations that could live on a blockchain. And you could build consensus engines, you could build reputation systems, you could do gambling, you could do whatever you want to do. Our job is to build the foundation. The world's job is to find what the applications are.
Okay, now one article suggests that Ethereum could replace or make obsolete Bitcoin.
No, we actually view Bitcoin to be kind of like gold and Ethereum to be more like oil in terms of the economics and how we've designed the system. So Bitcoin makes a really good store of value. If you put your money into it, no matter when you put it in, over the long term, you've made a lot of money. And our hope is that's going to continue, especially because of the deflationary economic model. Ethereum is more like a gigantic computational engine where people build things on top and they use their computational engine to do things in a trustless way. And the fuel that runs that engine is Ether, the base unit of value in our ecosystem. So they have different use cases, and I think they actually can live in harmony. And that's actually why Roger Ver said in a recent video, hey, Bitcoin and Ethereum are great things to work together.
Okay, so they're complementary.
Exactly.
Okay, now you're a cryptographer. So before Bitcoin, there was something called cryptography.
Right.
And the Satoshi Nakamoto in the Bitcoin phenomenon is, you know, cryptography, the way it works, it could be turned into a currency.
Mm-hmm.
Because the computing power necessary to solve computational problems for cryptography, mm-hmm, is setting up a situation where harnessing a network of folks together to do the... In other words, my question is, what was that light bulb moment? I think this would be interesting. There's cryptography. It existed before Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
What was Satoshi's insight? What was that light bulb moment? What exactly the transition from, aha, cryptography to a currency model? If that's a legitimate question.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, how would you describe that?
There's really two cryptographic primitives that are used in Bitcoin. One is a primitive used for consensus. So there's this idea of the blockchain where I put things into the blockchain and they don't come out. And it's trusted and secure across all parties. So you need a hashing algorithm to do that. We use SHA-256. MaxCoin uses SHA-3, which is better. So there's...
MaxCoin is better?
Well...
How so?
SHA-3 is great.
Because it's a
new cryptographic primitive. It uses a sponge construction. There's all this magic behind it. So I like SHA-3 more than SHA-256. But there's the debate.
There's no debate. MaxCoin is better. Before we're jumping ahead, I want to get back into the insight of,
right,
you know, of the cryptography. It's used for secure online transactions.
So there's two things, right? So the first is to make sure that the database is secure. So the ledger itself is secured by a mining process, and that mining process relies on a hash algorithm. The second thing is, how do you spend your money? Who gives you the right to do that? So it's called public key cryptography. In the particular case of a Bitcoin, it uses ECDSA, elliptic curve digital signing algorithm. And there's two parts, a public address that everybody in the world can know, and that's fine. And then there's a private key that only the person who has the right to spend the money has. So these two things put together actually allow you to create a completely decentralized and trustless currency.
Okay, would it be correct to say that the problem Bitcoin solves is double spending?
Yes, it solves double spending.
Okay, because before then, I could send somebody an electronic token, but I could conceivably do that and send it out to 10 people at the same time.
Right.
Because and that's the problem.
You needed a central authority to maintain the database to inhibit double spending. But with the hashing algorithm, you actually have digital consensus in a decentralized way to prevent you from counterfeiting.
Right. So to verify...
So it creates digital scarcity, in a sense, which is the first time that's ever been done.
I'll talk a little bit more about that, a digital scarcity.
Yeah, so effectively, once you have a database that's secured by consensus, nobody in the ecosystem, nobody in the world can tamper with that unless they gain an overwhelming amount of hash power in the network. So effectively, when you have tokens that are in that database, those tokens are scarce. They can't be cloned or replicated. So just like gold, it has that property, and that's very unique. It's never been done before in a digital sense.
The tokens are the bitcoins.
Exactly.
Right, so you're paying the people who are lending their CPU, their computers, mm-hmm. to hash, and in exchange, they're getting a token.
Yep.
Now, those tokens, it just so happens, can be used now like money.
And that's why it was an experiment, because when it was first built, the tokens had no value. Then you could buy a pizza for 10,000 of them, and now a lot of people are millionaires as a result of the appreciation of value, because they're scarce.
Okay, right. And so scarcity, here's another description I would apply to a Bitcoin on the scarcity issue.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you could say Bitcoin, the idea of a Bitcoin or the solutions to these cryptological problems have always existed since the beginning of time, but only in the last 5 years has there been enough computer power and the ability to network computers to actually go into the digital space and mine them. You could, like, for example, gold's been in the Earth's crust forever, but it took technology and capital to go mine the gold. The idea of turning a cryptological solution into a currency, it's kind of there since the beginning of time, you could say, because mathematics has been with us since the beginning of time.
Right.
But it was only in the last few years that you could harness together a network of computers, solve this for this problem, and get at this extremely scarce number, this precious mm-hmm. number. And I call them precious numbers for this in this way, and a monetized precious number. Is that fair?
So,
or is that crazy?
Or
is that overly poetic?
You needed a lot of magic things to happen for Bitcoin to exist. You needed the guys in the 80s who were thinking about digital currencies to do their things. You needed Wei Dai to do this work with Crypto++. You needed Adam Back to go ahead and create Hashcash. And all of these things aggregated together at this beautiful paradigm-shifting focal point, which was Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper. And it was really the capstone. And we do this all the time in math. If you look at Andrew Wiles when he solved Fermat's Last Theorem, it wasn't just Andrew Wiles. There was hundreds of people because you needed all those mathematicians that came before to build something, some tool to give him. So Bitcoin is really the capstone of that. And Ethereum is the next step, our hope is. We're looking at everything that's been done in the Bitcoin ecosystem. We've looked at all the innovations, all the failures, and said, okay, now that we know these things, let's try to build another step. And then somebody's going to build another step after us.
So the intrinsic value story for Bitcoin and Ethereum all comes back to scarcity.
Yeah, it comes back to scarcity in a sense, and it also comes back to the social network around the money. Money,
right,
is
but
all
scarcity is something that very few people are talked about in a way that seems to resonate out there, because people just assume that digits are infinite, but they're not in this case, because these are solutions and numbers that require vast arrays of computers to solve for. In translating into scarcity. But anyway, we've got to go. And I told you we'd be running out of time quickly and we'd be all crying about it. But in fact, we're out of time. So I must say goodbye. But thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you so much, Max.
All right. Super. And that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Charles Hoskinson of the Ethereum Project. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Everybody. So they will be back. Somebody's going to get their fingers slapped, at least. Nasara now, huh, everybody? Okay, let's get with our little When Rocks Cry Out here. Don't worry about it. All right. So where are we on this story? We read a little bit about this chapter yesterday, but we'll read it again. Chapter 32, Ancient Hieroglyphs Name Cities in the Yucatan Peninsula. From his military base near Jericho, Joshua sent his warriors to attack a city called Ai, that was no small feat, as Ai is located on the Yucatan Peninsula. In the country we now call Belize. I've been all these places, I have indeed in this life. The Hebrews had to ply across 1,000 miles of Atlantic and Caribbean seas to reach Ai. There are, no, they didn't take a spaceship. They didn't. There are tons of communities in Belize right now. All kinds of amazing people are living there, and they are doing some amazing stuff down there. Yet why had Joshua set his heart against Ai? Biblical history about Abraham could provide an answer to that. Quote, "Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will shew thee. So Abram departed, as the Lord had spoken unto him, and went forth to go into the land of Canaan. And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Sichem, unto the plain of Moreh. And the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed I will give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord who appeared to him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar. On modern maps that show ancient Maya cities, the Old Testament city Ai seemed to be the Mayan city called Ha, or Altun-Ha. Biblical passages place Ai and Hai east of Bethel. The name Ai and Hai appear to be two Old Testament names for the same city. Clearly, the name Ai is embedded in the name Hai, H-A-I. There is a major mountain range to the west of the Maya city, Altun-Ha. Yet more amazing is the Maya place called Altar of Sacrifice that stands between Altun-Ha on the east and the mountain range on the west. There must have been some important reason why this Maya place was named Altar of Sacrifice. Was this the place where Abraham had built his altar? I was not sure. Still, Joshua's ships had plied the waves of an ocean and seas to reach Ai. Maybe Joshua knew the old traditions about Abraham and this place. Was Joshua going to Ai because that was the place where ancient traditions said Abraham was when the divine promise of land was delivered to him? Modern maps call this country where Altun-Ha is Belize. Amazingly, ancient Egyptian writings give this place the same name, calling it Ba'ilos. When modern historians broke the code of Egypt's hieroglyphics and began to decipher and publish those writings, they unwittingly decoded histories about cities and places in the Americas. The following is what Brugsch published about the Maya city called Tikal, whose pyramids and expansive ruins are located in the south-central region of the Yucatan Peninsula. Very awesome place, everybody. Bruges interpreted the Egyptian hieroglyphic name of the city to be Thukul. Lying east of the Tanite Nome was the Aeth or Sethroite, whose capital bore the name of Patmu, city of Tmu, the Pithom of the Bible. This town formed the central point of a district, the name of which is of foreign origin, for Thuku, or Succoth, is a Semitic word signifying a tent or camp. This was pasture land and the property of Pharaoh, and on it the wandering Bedouin of the eastern deserts pitched their tents in order to procure necessary food for their cattle. Here, the Israelites first encamped at the time of the Exodus, moving on the second day to a place called Etham, which was either in the country of Succoth or in its close neighborhood. Tikal is located in the region called Paten, or Peyton, P-E-T-E-N. This is the name, is the same Peyton named in Moses' autobiography. By locating the biblical Pithom near to the Mayan city Tikal and near to other Mayan cities, Bruges had unknowingly confirmed that Moses had fled to the Yucatan Peninsula. Bruges ran into a dead end while trying to find Tikal and Avaris in the Egypt in South Northeast Africa. However, that was inevitable, Bruges confessed. Quote, "The gradual silting up of the ancient bed of the River Nile of Africa has made the situation of the towns on its banks so difficult to determine that there is scarcely a hope of finding again the site of the lost city of Avaris." Unquote. Quote, "Another town on the east side of the delta bore the name of Pa-ba-ilos, Belbis, the Semitic origin of which is made clear by its evident relationship with the Hebrew balos, the large sycamore." Bruges had published for modern eyes the names of several Maya places on the Yucatan Peninsula, including Peyton, Bekan, Tikal, Altun High, and Belis. He was reading from ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic texts. And I pass this long stem lavender rainbow rose Excalibur emerald serpent feathered Quetzalcoatl talking stick to my sister Rainbird and all of our sister Rainbird. Here you go, sister. Pass it to you.
I got it. Thank you, Tara, and thank you, Mama. What a great day. Can you hear me? It seems so quiet.
I can hear you very well.
Okay. Well, here we are at this, this special new moon day, and so it seems profound enough to check out the angel messages for 11 degrees Pisces. And it's the angels, the Volman are the name of the angels, V-O-L-L-M-A-N, and they are the angels of light. And so I thought I'd share this one. It's very short. Okay, Volman, the angels of light. Beloved, The previous 339 degrees of the zodiac prepare humankind for immersion in an understanding of light. Now is the time for enlightenment concerning the creation of delight. We initiate people into the most subtle mysteries of light. Following our instructions, people will reach a degree of maturity where they can apply the nuances of light to create miracles. They are able to achieve anything with light in the three planes of emotion, mind, and materiality, and enter a state of indescribable happiness. Light waves carry information. Colored light carry information of correlating qualities. By comprehending the divine virtues, a person visualizes colors with such power that miraculous changes manifest on all levels of consciousness because colors have been so integrated into perception through day-to-day meditation that now they are automatically imbued with their appropriate cosmic qualities, images, concepts, emotions, usable tones, and sensations. A person who works with light in this manner is at the stage where miracles burst like lightning from the imagination. The skill of using light is a joyous path of spiritual proficiency, providing each person with a tool for demonstrating the seventh heaven of delight for self and others. And what could be more wonderful? This powerful use of will and visualization of light is so profound it is used for any transformation needed to bring heaven to earth. And then Cynthia tells a story about that, and that's just the way it is. Let's bring in the light and express gratitude for all of our lives and all the ways we show up in our lives, and express some gratitude for Tara and Rama and all that they do, and Teddy and for her notes, and Cheryl for her meditation, and Marita for her many, many connections and having that great Stargate Roundtable program every Thursday. And all the others that I'm not mentioning. Richard and Edward, thank you for your life. And just thank you for everyone. We're grateful for all of our lives and all that we do here to bring forth this great change of the ages. Home Atakriyaka and I pass this talking stick. Right back at you, Rama. How about something beautiful music?
Okay, sister, we're going to do a Rumi again, the poetry of Rumi. This is another one. I just love Rumi. Here we go. MythicImagination.org is where you can go find this.
Net music, please. Some gnats come from the grass to speak with Solomon. Oh, Solomon, you are the champion of the oppressed. You give justice to the little guys, and they don't get any littler than us. We are tiny metaphors for frailty. Can you defend us? Who has mistreated you? Our complaint is with the wind. Well, says Solomon, you have pretty voices, you gnats. But remember, a judge cannot listen to just one side. I must hear both litigants. Of course, agree the gnats. Summon the east wind, calls out Solomon.
and the wind arrives almost immediately. What happened to the net plaintiffs? Gone. Such is the way of every seeker who comes to complain at the high court. When the presence arrives, where are the seekers? First there's dying, then union like nets inside the wind.
Hey, good.
You gonna do one? No.
You're supposed to do these little
things. Okay, I'll do these.
They're your own.
Huh?
I'll read one once in a while.
Okay.
You do the next one.
Inside water, a water wheel turns. A star circulates with the moon. We live in this night ocean, wondering, what are these lights? Little quatrain. Inside water, a water wheel turns. A star circulates with the moon. We live in this night ocean, wondering, what are these lights?
One more, come on.
This moment, this love comes to rest in me. Many beings in one being, in one wheat grain, 1,000 sheaf stacks. Inside the needle's eye, a turning night of stars. Inside the needle's eye, a turning night of stars. I am so small, I can barely be seen. How can this great love be inside me? Look at your eyes. They're small, but they see enormous things. I am so small, I can barely be seen. How can this great love be inside me? Look at your eyes. They're small, but they see enormous things.
This is the first translation that Coleman did of Rumi that I memorized of his. Come to the garden in spring. Come to the garden in spring. There's wine and light and sweethearts in the pomegranate blossoms. If you do not come, these do not matter. If you do come, these do not matter. You know, when I read it, I say, that's a genius Coleman has to understand how incredible the word matter is in English. Matter. Come to the orchard in spring. There's light and wine and sweethearts in the pomegranate blossoms. If you do not come, then these things are not really very important. And if you do come, these things are not very important. What? If you do not come, these do not matter. If you do come, these do not matter.
Come to the land of freedom's holy flame, everyone. And yes, these things do not matter. Yet, is it not appropriate that spring is in a couple of weeks? And I love you so much. And the number for Cheryl Croce's call both Sunday and Monday evenings at 1:45 of 9 on the East Coast,
quarter of the hour of 6 on the West Coast. The number is the same as here, 213-342-3000. And the PIN code is 946-7441 pound. 946-7441 pound. Another day, and we are in a new month, and we are in a new year as they, in the cultures all over the world, celebrate spring as the new year coming here now. Let us be prepared. Let us know that the silence of one hand clapping is a beautiful space. And with love all around us, I bid you farewell tonight and much aloha and mahalo for your presence with all of us together this evening. And inshallah, I am another yourself.
Sat Nam Ji.
Aho Mitakwiasan. Aloha, everyone. Namaste.